Welcome to Physics and Religion, a series of podcasts exploring the relationship between modern science and religion. Science and religion intersect on many levels, moral, ethical, and political. In these podcasts, I will be primarily interested on the ways that science impacts on Judeo-Christian theology. We might talk about the intelligent design movement, about sociobiology, and about the way in which the modern cosmology challenges and enriches our sense of place in the universe. In the next few podcasts, however, I would like to talk about human consciousness. The issue here is not so much what science can tell us, which is a lot, but what, for profound reasons, it can't. It seems impossible to understand consciousness in purely physical terms, which suggests that there is a dimension of reality over, above, and beyond the purely physical. Perhaps you believe this already, but I want to come upon this hypothesis, not necessarily from some faith tradition, but from the notion, from the point of view, of hard-nosed science. I use the word hypothesis advisedly. This subject is nothing if not controversial. But that's what we academics like. People sometimes ask me how I, as a scientist, can have anything to do with religion. Are not the two in a state of perpetual conflict? In fact, has science not somehow proved religion wrong? It seems that being a man of science and a man of faith is an act of deep hypocrisy. That's a fair point. I would like to answer it first before we get to the content of these lectures. I sense two different attitudes towards religion and the supernatural in the scientific community. First, one might say that science, by definition, does not deal with the supernatural. That is not to say that there is or is not a supernatural dimension to reality, just that if there is, science has nothing to do with it. Suppose, for example, I have some data that don't make sense. I might say that my graduate student screwed up. She does that all the time. Or that I am on the verge of a great scientific discovery and need further funding. These are very scientific things to say, and scientists say them all the time. What I must not say is that the data are infected by evil spirits. They may actually be so infected. And after going without sleep for 48 hours, I may even have seen them flitting around the particle accelerator. It's just that when I offer this as an explanation, I'm not doing science. This is sort of an informal pact that scientists have worked out with the rest of society. After all, what we call science was once called natural theology. It was with the rise of professional scientific societies at the beginning of the 19th century that scientists feel the need to distance themselves from religion. The creation of the universe is a good example. What came before the Big Bang? There are a number of very speculative theories. After all, we don't have much to go on. So why not just give up and say that God created it all? Maybe he did. But as scientists, we are committed to exploring as far as we can without making that assumption. Or, to put it another way, if God did create the universe, how? This is my point of view at any rate, and it seems very, very reasonable. The second point of view is that the supernatural simply does not exist. To that extent, all religion is wrong. The laws of physics are closed and complete. One way of stating this is that everything in the universe can be explained in principle, starting with the laws of physics. A slightly weaker statement is that once the laws of physics are in place, the universe follows of logical necessity, even if we cannot necessarily explain how this happens. As the philosophers like to put it, the universe is supervenient on the laws of physics. I should explain in passing that the word supervenience means roughly that the properties of a higher level system are determined by some lower level system. This is intuitively clear, but it seems almost impossible to formulate a rigorous definition. There are somewhat different versions of this basic position, variously called materialism, naturalism, or physicalism. For our purposes, we don't have to make a distinction. The important point is that these are not things that science proves. If someone tells you that science has proved that there is no God, don't take anything else he says seriously. You might say these are statements of faith. Still, there is a lot of evidence in their favor. All the progress that science has made has been predicated on just this hypothesis. Not only that, the history of science and theology is littered with failed attempts to prove the existence of God by appealing to something that at the time science was unable to explain. Newton, for example, thought that God had to intervene constantly to keep the planets in stable orbits. A century later, Laplace was able to show that the planets could take care of themselves. People used to believe that God created all animal species in their present form. Some people still do believe this. But genetic mutation, together with natural selection, provide a complete scientific explanation. These are so-called God of the gaps arguments, claiming that some gap in our scientific knowledge proves the existence of God. Part of the appeal of materialism is that no one wants to be caught making a God of the gaps argument. I suppose there's a third point of view. Let's call it the don't have a clue materialism. Most scientists haven't given these issues any thought and would prefer not to. Perhaps this is just my chauvinism, but I sense that this attitude is less common in physics than it is, say, in the life science. For example, each year the Templeton Foundation awards a prize of 1.1 million pounds to a living person who, and I'm quoting now, has made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension, whether through insight, discovery, or practical works. The winners from these last 15 years include Martin Rees, Bernard d'Espagne, Michael Heller, John Barrow, Charles Townes, George Ellis, and John Polkinghorne. All of these men are distinguished physicists. That brings me to the subject of human consciousness. As a physicist, I am tempted to say that the laws of physics are complete and closed, that the universe is supervenient on the laws of physics. But there's a problem. There seems to be at least one thing in the universe that is not supervenient, and that's consciousness. If that is true, it means there is another dimension to reality, one that we are all intimately familiar with, but which is invisible to science. This is an especially relevant subject to discuss in church, because our consciousness is the arena for our encounters with God. Incidentally, I said if it is true that consciousness is not supervenient on the laws of physics. This is still a disputed subject in philosophy, but I hope to show later that at least all the attempts I am aware of to show how consciousness might supervene on the material world suffer from various logical flaws. I will mostly be dealing with human consciousness, but that raises an important question. What about animals? Are animals conscious? The octopus makes an interesting example. Lauren Isley called octopuses the wisest of the cephalopods. If this remark fascinates you, be sure to read The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the World of Consciousness by Cy Montgomery. The author finds them smart, charming, and affectionate, to say nothing of ambidextrous. But the word cephalopod, as I'm sure you have guessed, comes from a Greek word meaning head feet. It refers to a class of marine animals, including the squid and cuttlefish. You might say that the octopus has its head in its feet, and in fact, 2/3 of an octopus's neurons are in its arms. They have acute eyesight, but I imagine that much of their perception of reality comes from their sense of touch. So, if they are conscious, as Lauren Isley and Cy Montgomery would claim, what is it like to be an octopus? Bats are another interesting case. Bats also have good eyesight, but they navigate through the total darkness of caves using echolocation. Their feats of navigation are quite remarkable. A mother bat can find her infants among a million other screaming bats. As the philosopher Thomas Nagel famously asked, what is it like to be a bat? I'll rephrase these questions for dramatic effect. What is it like to see with your ears? What is it like to think with your feet? I would like to say that these questions shed light on the phenomenon of human consciousness. But in fact, you might say they shed darkness. They show how profoundly mysterious consciousness really is. For the time being, however, I would like to concentrate on one particular consciousness. Yours. For this, I need to indulge me in a little exercise. Sit down somewhere comfortable, close your eyes, and turn on all your powers of memory and imagination. Think of your earliest childhood memory. I have a clear memory of standing up in a crib. I must have been, 3 years old. Now think about growing up. Summon up special memories that have the warm glow of retrospection. Think about your hopes, dreams, fears, and ambitions. Remember the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to you. And then think of that moment when you first met the person who was destined to be your beloved life's partner. Have you ever had a religious experience? Have you ever felt the approach of God? If not the approach, then perhaps the approach of the approach? Hold that thought. Now, open your eyes and think about your brain. It consists of 3 pounds of gray meat, wrinkled like an old apple. When working at peak efficiency, it consumes about 12 watts of power, as much as a dim light bulb. It's just meat, thinking meat, caring meat, loving meat, and if there is any prospect of eternal life, it must somehow start here with the meat. You see, we have a problem. The philosopher David Chalmers calls this the hard problem, and adds that there is nothing we know more intimately than conscious experience, but nothing that is harder to explain. What we would like to explain is this. How do neurological, biological processes in the brain produce consciousness? This is called the mind-body problem. The intellectual abyss separating the two is called the explanatory gap. The problem might be so difficult, in fact, that as one philosopher put it, nothing worth reading has been written about it. Thank you.